PA Books is a production of PCN, a nonprofit television network. Listeners like you make our programming possible. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
This week on PA Books, Brady Kreitzer, author of The National Road.
Brady Kreitzer is the author of The National Road, George Washington and America's First Highway West. Brady, take us back to the 1790s in the area of western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio. What was that area like? What were some of the infrastructure challenges that were being faced back then?
The Ohio country, as they would have called the Ohio River Valley, was really an amazing place. It had a reputation in cities like Philadelphia and New York as the back country. But in the 1790s, especially, that era was sort of ending. It was a region not of Native American tribes, certainly in western Pennsylvania anymore, but increasingly is a region of Scots, Irish, German, and Welsh settlement. So what used to be endless forests were now being carved up into farms and plantations. There was a farming economy here that really drove the western frontier based on grain production, a little bit of corn, but mostly what they would call Monongahela rye. And they were really making a life of their own after the Revolution. They were revolutionary veterans. They fought for a very unique version of liberty that I think many in the East didn't understand. And they were making roadways, small local passages, many of them originally Native American trails, but I would say it was a region on the rise.
Now, you say in the book that the Ohio River was critical to controlling the fate of North America. Why was it so important?
Well, for the British especially, the Appalachian Mountains sort of is like the spine of America. And when we think of the 13 colonies, it hems them in. You know, they expand very steadily and slowly from the eastern seaboard, but the Appalachian Mountains represent a hard stop for them, especially a settlement like Carlisle. So if there was to be a way through those mountains and into the great unknown beyond, they would be interested. The Ohio River was really the superhighway west everybody was looking for. If you were to put a boat on the Ohio River, you could float it all the way down to Spanish New Orleans and the Gulf of Mexico, or if you went north, you could go along the Missouri River all the way to the Rocky Mountains without ever leaving your boat. So in a very real way, you know, the Ohio was the gateway to the West.
And drilling down a little bit deeper, the Forks of the Ohio becomes this significant strategic location as well for controlling the Ohio.
Yeah, from 1753 onwards, we see the British and French empires fighting on five different continents, but I like to say that, you know, all of them in their capitals, London and Paris, there is a table somewhere with a map of the Ohio River and specifically what is today Pittsburgh circled, because they were fighting for the future of the continent. And without controlling the Ohio River, the future was uncertain.
Now, your book is about the National Road, and so much of the early story is about just getting permission to do it and finding the money to do it. Let's just fast forward real quick and take us, once it was completed, what was the extent of the National Road?
The National Road was really America's first great infrastructure achievement at a time when we didn't have any to speak of. You know, before the Brooklyn Bridge or the Panama Canal, we had the National Road, but it was 683 miles stretching all the way from Baltimore almost to the Mississippi in Illinois, Vandalia, Illinois. It ran through Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia at the time, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois.
So as we go back then to this early Republic period, and it's a new Republic, everything's very fresh, national identity is still being formed. Why was connecting, say, the Potomac River area and the Ohio River so important at that time?
It was really from the mind of George Washington, truly, that we get this plan. Washington, as many of your viewers know, lives on the Potomac River, Mount Vernon. The new capital of Washington, D.C. will be on the river as well. He has this dream where a ship can enter the Potomac from the Atlantic Ocean and sail all the way to the distant west via the route I just described. The problem Washington has is that the Potomac ends its navigability at Cumberland, Maryland. And the Ohio River, the key gateway, is 130 miles away over land. So you almost have these two amazing waterways touching, but they don't quite do it. So George Washington has this plan to unify those waters. And he sees it probably in his mind as a canal, but he puts the wheels in motion through various treaties with native peoples, the British and the Spanish. He has to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion. He puts those wheels in motion to connect them with what will ultimately be a highway.
Now, there's a lot of politics involved in building this roadway as well, or building this connection between the Potomac and the Ohio. Take us through some of the challenges, the intercolonial challenges that would eventually lead up to the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah, so Washington's dream of unifying those two rivers, the river of his youth, the Potomac, and the river of the future, the Ohio, it has to deal with the realities of living in a post-revolutionary world. You know, the Potomac is a shared resource between Virginia and Maryland. So, you know, clearing that river, making it fully navigable, is going to require two states to work together, not just one. And he's really all in this for his home state of Virginia. So he has a meeting at Mount Vernon in 1785. Between the Virginians and the Marylanders. And we call it the Mount Vernon Conference, just to deal with this Potomac issue. And he doesn't get a satisfactory result. And he does think more players need to be involved. So in 1786, they're going to meet in Annapolis, Maryland, and invite many more states. Some show up, some don't. And that one also stalls. Washington finally says, let's just have a big convention of all the states in 1787 in Philadelphia. And of course, he does get the interstate cooperation he was looking for, the canals down the road, so to speak, but he ends up with a constitution and being president of the United States, which I don't think he anticipated. So in a way, Washington's quest for this infrastructure investment leads to the Constitutional Convention. It's really remarkable.
One of the key figures in this story is Albert Gallatin. Who is he?
Albert Gallatin was kind of the champion of the West. He was born in Geneva, Switzerland, and he moved to America in the middle of the Revolution to Boston. He found it very boring, and then he moved to Fayette County, which is southwestern Pennsylvania, and he saw just nothing but raw potential. He was about 5'5". He had pointy nose, bald head, thick French accent, but the frontier was a whole world of accents. That's where all the immigrants went. So he was adopted by them. He was elected to the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives eventually. And when Thomas Jefferson became president in 1801, kind of spearheading the states' rights, conservative, small government ethos, Gallatin was his obvious choice to be Treasury Secretary because he was so good with numbers. And Gallatin would actually go on to be our longest serving Treasury Secretary for presidents.
Now, George Washington had his vision for a transportation connection between the Potomac and the Ohio. Was Gallatin aware of what Washington wanted to do, or did he have his own idea?
Well, Gallatin, and this is where my book opens, Gallatin and Washington meet in 1784 in a log cabin on a place called George's Creek in southwestern Pennsylvania in the wilderness, and they talk this over. And it was years from happening, 16 years from happening. But Albert Gallatin would later write, literally on a letter, this is the origin of the National Road. So he understood Washington's plan. Washington dies in 1799. And Gallatin's kind of the one that assumes the mantle. He differs with Washington this far. Washington views America kind of as a world of sails. But for Gallatin, who lives in the West, he knows it's going to be a world of wheels very quickly, wagon wheels. So Gallatin will finance the National Road. And this is something maybe we'll get into later, but through some real financial trickery. I mean, he does an amazing job And he creates this enormous and important resource we still have today.
So what did it take to get to the start of construction? How much politics were involved? Was legislation needed? How did they solve these problems?
The biggest stumbling block truly was Thomas Jefferson as president, because he had a very strict view of the Constitution. He called himself a constructionist, meaning if it wasn't in the document, he would not do it. And he criticized other presidents, you know, for being fast and loose with the document. So when Gallatin came to him with this proposal for an interstate highway, I mean, the only thing we ever built before this was four lighthouses. We had a capital with very raw buildings under construction. We hadn't made anything yet. And Jefferson's fear of this national road was that, number one, you know, was it constitutional? He didn't know. And number two, it would have to go through at least three states, and you would need state governments to sign off on that. So Gallatin's plan, and this is his real genius, I think, was he found a way to make this road kind of tax neutral. He said, it's going to benefit Westerners. Let's make it, you know, be paid for by Westerners. It could even be built by Westerners. So the United States at this time is selling land in Ohio. That's how we're largely financing our government. Settlers will buy land in Ohio from the federal government. Gallatin took a few cents of each dollar and sort of compiled it into a fund. And that money was what was used to build the National Road. So it was tax neutral. The Constitution says that the federal government must maintain roads for delivering mail, postal roads. Really kind of a strange footnote in the Constitution. But Gallatin tells Jefferson, well, this can be our postal road. So right there, he shows Jefferson it won't cost us anything. That's true in the beginning, not later. And we're constitutionally mandated to do this. So that kind of clears the way there. 1806, we'll see the first legislation pass for the National Road, but we won't see ground broken until 1811. So this is very on brand for Congress, I like to say. They begin, this group of politicians who are not engineers, micromanaging every single little aspect of this road, how wide it should be, no more than a 5% grade. But my favorite thing that they do is they say that the road needs to be constructed of two layers of stone, the bottom layer being 7 inches in diameter per stone and the top being 3 inches in diameter per stone. And they give these poor road workers iron rings, one 7 inches across and one 3 inches across. And because it's the law, these workers have to measure every single individual stone. And if one stone is too big, they have to tinker it down with a hammer until it meets the congressional standard. So the long story short, how does it take so long to build this road, Phil? That's why it takes so long, mostly because of Congress.
So talk about the route. How did they decide where it would start and where it would end and what route would it take?
You know, history in many ways is about memory, how we remember the past. Roads, I think, preserve history. So the original route from Cumberland, Maryland, Fort Cumberland, into the West was, believe it or not, forged by George Washington in 1754. That was a very small path, but that was expanded in 1755 by Major General Edward Braddock. And that road became, you know, the key passage for Virginians moving into the West. The engineering of the Braddock Road in 1755 was remarkable, clearing trees, expanding the road, but it was also remarkable because they surveyed really the best way through a pretty treacherous wilderness. And really from Cumberland to the tip of Chestnut Ridge, which is today around Uniontown, they just paved over the old Braddock Road. I mean, the surveying was mostly done for them. And then once they got to Chestnut Ridge, this beautiful high peak overlooking the Allegheny Plateau, there were already smaller roads that led to the Ohio River, so they really just had to improve those too. So they were taking very old roads and finishing them. And these are roads we still drive today. And it really kind of lets history jump out at us that way.
We'll be back in a moment with the PA Books podcast.
Enjoying this podcast? Please support PCN with a donation at PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
So why did they take that route instead of, say, moving west from Philadelphia? There's a Lancaster Pike, Forbes Road moved west over the mountains. Why not take that route?
That was a big fight because everyone knew that whoever had the origin of the road would become the champion of Western commerce. You know, when they're debating this national road, the state of New York by itself, no federal money, builds the Erie Canal. And that connects New York City to the Great Lakes. And even though New York City is an Atlantic power, that makes them sort of a Western superpower all of a sudden. And that puts every state on edge. Pennsylvania wants to build a canal across its state. The key thing that worked in favor of the National Road was that there was already a road from Baltimore to Cumberland, and that's been there since the colonial period. And they thought, well, we can use that road as kind of the first leg of this highway, and then we can start at Cumberland and just head toward the Ohio River from there. Now, Jefferson wanted this road to be straight as possible after it reached Chestnut Ridge, Uniontown, because straight equals very cheap. I think people have a good understanding of that. But the state of Pennsylvania said they would not validate or pass the legislation on their end in Harrisburg, because if they made it a straight line, it would skip all the major cities of southwestern Pennsylvania, specifically Uniontown and Washington, PA. And one of the things that I found in my book, and this had never really been published before, was that Albert Gallatin received a letter from a state senator named David Acheson saying that his constituents in Washington, Pennsylvania, were threatening to open fire on the road crews unless the road came through their communities. And, you know, Gallatin took this to the president and said, these are the people that were whiskey rebels just 10 years earlier. When they say they're going to shoot the road crews, they're serious. So they had to divert the road 26 miles north just to appease the Washingtonians. They're a tough bunch, so I understand it. And Gallatin knew that.
So as they were building this road, we talked about Uniontown and Washington, but just give us a sense of what parts of Pennsylvania the road runs through.
Yeah, so the road will enter Pennsylvania right around what is today Addison. At the time, it was called Petersburg. And it will make its way steadily toward the Monongahela River. So from there, it goes through places like Farmington, which, of course, we know as the site of the Battle of Fort Necessity, Chalk Hill, which is where General Braddock will be buried. It'll then climb Chestnut Ridge and descend into Uniontown. And from Uniontown, it's going to hit Brownsville on the Monongahela River. And that's a really important spot because that's the direct connection to Pittsburgh. People might be asking, well, why didn't the road go to Pittsburgh? It didn't need to because the Monongahela was a direct feeder toward Pittsburgh to the north. 40% of all vehicles who travel the National Road, by the way, never got past Brownsville because they hit the Monongahela and went to Pittsburgh. But from there, it's going to, again, as I mentioned, very contentiously head to Washington at the pain of another potential whiskey rebellion. And it will turn a little bit southwest toward Wheeling. The last city in Pennsylvania it's going to hit is called New Alexander on the Pennsylvania border, West Alexander on the Pennsylvania-West Virginia border.
Why was Wheeling chosen as a site?
That was also a little bit of a debate. Steubenville really wanted it, but what worked against Steubenville, Ohio, was that south of it, there were rapids in the Ohio River, and government officials didn't want ships loading up only to be caught up in rapids. If they went to Wheeling, they would avoid that. It was pretty smooth sailing. There were other places along the way, places like West Liberty, West Virginia. They said there was too much flooding immediately in the vicinity around it, and they weren't wrong. It still floods all the time. So Wheeling was kind of the natural choice. Plus, the Virginians, carrying on Washington's legacy, really pushed for that. Wheeling was part of Virginia. There was no West Virginia yet. And for the Virginians, you know, Wheeling was kind of their stake in the Western future of America. Like, they were certainly an East Coast power, but they didn't lose sleep at night because they knew they had Wheeling. They didn't know that they would lose that by the time of the Civil War. So they still had a lot of influence in that decision.
So was the intent that the road would end there, or was it always intended to keep moving west?
Well, the original intent, as Washington and Gallatin saw it, was just to hit the Ohio River. because that's what America was at the time. I mean, beyond that, you're talking about Spanish territory. So by 1825, we realize that's starting to change. America gets a whole bunch of new Western lands it never had before. Obviously, the Louisiana Purchase. John Quincy Adams will negotiate a treaty with the Spanish. And America's future looks far bigger than it used to. So Congress will amend the road to go all the way to the Mississippi. And from 1818 to 1825, the road doesn't really expand anywhere beyond Wheeling. But with that new legislation, and the legislation says it must go through state capitals. So that's why Columbus and Indianapolis and Vandalia, Illinois, are more or less a straight line at the time. That kind of gives a new birth to the national road as Americans need it.
Now, there was a road in Ohio called Zane's Trace. And who was Ebenezer Zane, and what route did his road take?
Yeah, so Zane's Trace was kind of a hint at the possibilities of the national road. Between 1796 and 1797, Zane built road. It was more of a large trail through the forest from Wheeling, Virginia, westward through Ohio, back to what was called Limestone, Kentucky, today Maysville, Kentucky. And he did this because, you know, just as Westerners were saying, they needed an outlet to move west. But Congress actually financed that before they financed the National Road, because again, constitutionally, they needed a postal road. The Constitution said Congress must maintain a postal road. So Zane's Trace was kind of the earliest lifeblood of the region. And when the National Road finally crosses the Ohio River and construction begins in Ohio in 1825, just like they improved the Braddock Road for a length of it, several miles, they improved Zane's Trace. So again, roads, like I said, they carry a memory, and we pave over them and preserve them for later generations, I think.
Another key figure here was David Shriver. What was his role in the construction of the road?
David Shriver was the first, we'll call, superintendent of the National Road. He was Gallatin's handpicked man. He was a Democratic Republican like Gallatin, but he was a fine road builder. He had built a number of good roads in Maryland. So it was up to Shriver to levy contracts. You know, they built the National Road in sections. It was his job to maintain sort of the day-to-day operations of construction. And the interesting thing is, just like today, as soon as they finish a section of the road, people would start to use it. But as they used it, they would be destroying it. That's why we still have potholes everywhere. So Shriver had to build a road and maintain a road at the same time. And in the middle of that, the War of 1812 begins. He starts to feel a financial squeeze there from Gallatin. Gallatin has to pay for the war. Shriver, I think very astutely, actually offers land, which there was an abundance of, to any British soldiers who would abandon the British cause and help build the road. So if you were a British soldier serving in America in the War of 1812, if you would go AWOL and you were willing to pick up a hammer and an axe and work, you would get free land in the West. I don't know if he had many takers on that, but it really kind of showed where his mind was.
So you mentioned earlier that Gallatin's plan to finance this. Let's talk a little bit more about that in detail.
Yeah.
Talk about how he managed to do this in a way that got everybody to agree to it.
Well, you know, Gallatin's amazing because we always think of him as like a number cruncher, if we even remember him. But he was very politically astute. I mean, this is a man that finances the Louisiana Purchase and the Lewis and Clark Expedition and the National Road and the War of 1812, all at the same time lowering the national debt. I mean, what we wouldn't give for a Gallatin, you know, in the 20th and 21st century to do that. But he understood, you know, the politics of the West, and I think that's where his real strength was. Washington, D.C. at that time is a place of balls and galas and soirees and, you know, exorbitant wealth. And Gallatin was always known as kind of a plain frontier, plain frontier host. He would have people over. There wouldn't be music. There wouldn't be alcohol. He was born in Europe, but he really adopted those Western sensibilities. But one of the things he would do is he would, to your question, he would invite young congressmen, first and second term congressmen, to dine with he and his wife, Hannah, and he would counsel them on all kinds of matters because he had been in the House and he had been in the Senate for years. He knew this. Gallatin was kind of the elder statesman, and he would help these congressmen who were living in dormitories, believe it or not. They didn't even really have their own homes, deal with navigate the issues of political life. And as he was doing that, he was becoming a mentor to them, and that was genuine. But I think he understood, you know, their vote was as good as anybody else's too. So he kind of developed this following of advisees, if you want to think of it that way, pupils that could rely on him for advice, and he could rely on them for votes.
So when they were there, regional rivalries involved in the politics of this, since it goes through Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, and connects to Ohio. Did representatives and senators from the South and the Northeast, how did they feel about this project?
They felt very strongly against it for a lot of it. The National Road, it was always a fight to get it financed because, you know, senators from Georgia and Alabama and Florida and Maine and Massachusetts are saying, you know, we're paying for this road. We're calling it a national road. But how does it serve us? How does it serve the Gulf Coast? How does it serve, you know, Massachusetts and Cape Cod? It really geographically doesn't. And so this is when men like not just Gallatin, but also Henry Clay of Kentucky, he was, you know, probably the most important political figure of the 19th century to never be president. This is where they come in because they would always say the National Road is a starting point to what they called sort of an American system of internal improvements. We would call it an interstate highway system. They didn't know that yet. But they always would say, you know, we have to complete the road to the Mississippi first, and then we can take it north, and then we could take it south. Henry Clay of Kentucky had a plan to connect the National Road to the Natchez Trace, which went all the way to New Orleans. But they needed financing to do it, and they needed political allies to do it. And they didn't always have them.
So can you drive the National Road today?
The National Road, you can drive it with only a few exceptions, and I mean very minor exceptions, perfectly from Cumberland, Maryland, really all the way to Vandalia, Illinois. It's State Route 40. So if you're on State Route 40, you know, you're on the Braddock Road for part of it, which is the National Road later. But you're going to see what they saw, the same mountains and hills and peaks and valleys they had to negotiate, the same rivers they had to cross. I know a lot of folks in Pennsylvania saw that bridge emerge from the depths of the lake, the Youghiogheny River. That was a National Road bridge. President James Monroe was there when it was opened. I mean, you can follow it. You can follow it. And again, it's just, it's a pleasant drive, and it gives us a chance to connect with the past that we otherwise wouldn't.
We've been speaking with Brady Kreitzer. He is the author of The National Road, George Washington and America's First Highway West. Brady, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Listeners like you make PCN programming possible. Full episodes of PA Books, as well as other PCN programs, are available to stream with the PCN Select app. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.